to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star and zero on your touchtone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Caring for Your Bones When You Have Breast Cancer, What's New? And I want to say that this is a very impressive group of participants on our program today. We have over 1,082 participants on the call today. So there are lots of you. Indeed, for this topic, this is the largest audience we've had, so it's really a credit that you've joined us. Now, this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, which have really helped to reach so many of you. And also, of course, your interest in this topic. This has become a very important topic, actually, in the breast cancer community in general. Now, you come from all over the United States. You come from all different regions of the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, India, Korea, Malaysia, Pakistan, the Philippines, Venezuela, Virgin Islands, United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. So you truly are an international audience from all over the world. Now, I would like to take a moment and review with you some of the materials you received from Cancer Care. You have received information about all of the different organizations that have collaborated with us to make this call possible, and they are wonderful resources for each of you to use as you have questions or concerns. There also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to each complete that evaluation form at the end of today's program. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics and programs we should offer? Indeed, this topic is one that you have repeatedly said is an important one that you would like us to cover and offer more than once a year. Now, this activity today is supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. We really have a wonderful group of speakers today on our program. Just really, I would say the best of the best are on this program. And I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Joseph Lane. Dr. Lane is Professor of Orthopedic Surgery, Weill Medical College of Cornell University, Chief of Metabolic Bone Disease Service, Hospital for Special Surgery. Now, Dr. Lane is going to start by really discussing your bones in terms of screening for bone health and risk factors, prescription medication to promote bone health, and the role of nutrition, exercise, and calcium supplements. Dr. Lane?
Thanks, Carolyn. So you have a very packed program today, and a number of people are going to cover some other elements which will affect the skeleton. I'm trying to get you set in a situation where we are friendly to our skeleton. Now, obviously, people with breast cancer are individuals who have an event which requires a surgical procedure, followed by some manipulation of medications. It's to our advantage to keep the skeleton as healthy as possible, because many of the agents that are used to cure the cancer and ensure that to be controlled will have an effect on bone. And the healthier the bone is, the better you are able to tolerate the medication necessary to control the cancer. So what makes good bone health? Basically, an individual will be taking calcium and vitamin D and exercising during their early childhood and adolescence. And those signals will be incorporated into building a skeleton. Now, a peak bone mass is achieved somewhere around the age of 35 to 40. And then from there on, you live on that particular skeleton. Clearly, it's to our advantage to have had those exercises and medicines in hand so we could start with as much bone as possible. But regardless of whatever that bone level is, we have very good methods today to maintain it, even in the face of drug therapy and hormonal therapy. So the skeleton will respond to exercise, and when it's used, it will be retained. When it's not used, given the choice, the skeleton will gradually give up some of that bone. So exercise is absolutely critical. And you want to exercise all elements of your bone that is possible, such as including not only your spine, but your arms and your legs. The nutrients that make up the skeleton include calcium and vitamin D. Normally, a reasonable calcium intake is somewhere around 700 milligrams to 800 milligrams a day, up to maybe 1,200 milligrams. There are several forms of calcium. Calcium citrate appears to be the most easily handled, the most reliably taken, and will work even in the face of taking medicines to take care of indigestion, such as Nexium and Pepcid. The vitamin D is a little bit more of a tricky question. We're just learning more about it. The normal is somewhere around 20 to 30 nanograms per milliliter of 25-hydroxyvitamin D. This is a very common test that's being run by your physicians and certainly by your oncologist. And the goal would be to keep somewhat in the level of around 30. This is hard to obtain just by normal foods because there's very little vitamin D around except in salmon and some unusual fishes. Therefore, you're going to have to get this by either sunlight or by adjuncts. And basically, your internist, your oncologist will work with you, and most people need somewhere in the order between 1 to 2,000 units of vitamin D. There's exciting information to suggest vitamin D may, in fact, prevent breast cancer, and so there are, but this is an area where we need much better evidence. Right now, we're aiming at the 1 to 2,000 level. The third point, of course, is the medications necessary to maintain your skeleton. Now, to help you in this decision, you have to know where you start. And the easiest way to do that is to take a bone density machine, which will then determine your bone mass. And if you and it will fall into various areas such as normal, osteopenia, which is mild bone loss, or osteoporosis. Clearly, the lowest bone mass you start with, the more the need for us to be diligent in trying to correct it. So a bone density is very critical, particularly if you're going to take medications that affect the skeleton. There are some modifications of the bone density called the FRAX, which allows the considerations such as age, medication, include steroid use, your gender, and all sorts of other factors can be put into the equation, which will then tell you the risk for a fracture or not a fracture. And then finally, what to do about the skeleton. There are a number of medicines that work. Many of the medicines we use in the treatment of osteoporosis came out of the cancer world. So we have a lot of experience with these agents, and these agents may have twofold roles. One, to control your cancer, and two, to maintain your skeleton. The family of bisphosphonates, including intravenous Zometa and pimidronate, often used in cancer, are extremely effective in treating osteoporosis. And then there are other oral bisphosphonates which do the job depending on the dosage. Usually the dose for cancer is much higher than for osteoporosis, but that can be discussed with your oncologist. And then there are other agents which are beginning to appear, such as Prolia. Many of the anti-estrogen agents, such as tamoxifen and Avista, actually, while used for cancer, have effects on the skeleton. Plus, the final point is we now are beginning to have some anabolic agents, which are bone-building agents, but they have to be worked out. The final issue is that these bisphosphonates are appearing to have not only a role in protecting the skeleton, but also directing toward the cancer. We'll hear more about this. But at the same time, they also will affect and protect your skeleton against osteoporosis. So the bottom line is appropriate nutrition, calcium, and vitamin D, appropriate exercise, awareness of your bones status before you start your treatment, and then finally, some manipulation of drug therapy placed in the mix with your control of your cancer. I think we'll stop at this point, Caroline.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lane, for really setting the context in terms of explaining about the architecture of the bones, the structure, how they work, how to take care of them. Very helpful. Thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Hope Rugo. Dr. Rugo is professor of medicine. She's director of breast oncology and clinical trials education, UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. Dr. Rugo is a medical oncologist, and she's going to address overview of breast cancer, including causes of bone loss, treatment for bone metastases, and doctor-patient communication about quality of life concerns. Dr. Rugo?
Thank you so much, Carolyn, and thank you for doing these calls. I think there's such a tremendous educational opportunity for people to call into and ask questions. It's a perfect place to start after that nice overview of bone health because it's such an important issue for patients with breast cancer. First, if for patients who have early stage disease, the majority of women are cured of their cancer, and keeping yourself healthy in terms of your bones, your cardiovascular status, all of the other things that affect our morbidity, in other words, our general health and ability to function, and our survival are very important. And we're always very interested in how our treatments, which are helping to prevent recurrence or treating breast cancer, might affect other aspects of our health. And bone has been an area of great focus. We know that bone loss can occur in women who receive treatment for early stage breast cancer. Certainly the first and the easiest area to look at is women who go into menopause earlier than they would have. We use ovarian suppression as a treatment for premenopausal breast cancer, and then women who are perimenopausal will often go into menopause with the chemotherapy if they receive it for early stage disease. And then with the advent of our newer hormonal agents, the aromatase inhibitors that block production of estrogen in the tissues, we're really creating an estrogen-deprived environment in postmenopausal women, and that, of course, promotes bone loss. And we also know that for women who are at risk, we increase the risk of fractures as well. And these are osteopenic or osteoporotic-related fractures. So we have a number of different reasons why you can lose bone, but I think it's important to also keep in mind, and Dr. Lane mentioned this a little bit, that there are nutritional issues as well, exercise issues that we'll be talking a little bit more about. So keeping your bones healthy, if you don't use them, you don't have them. So health is really just your general health, keeping active, weight-bearing exercise, making sure that you have adequate vitamin D and calcium intake. And then another factor which none of us have control over is who our parents are. And genetics seem to play a very big role because when we've looked at women who had osteoporosis on studies that tested aromatase inhibitors in early stage breast cancer, we know that the women who had low bone mineral density to start with were at higher risk. There are many women who are postmenopausal whose bones are pretty good. And interestingly, our medications don't seem to make as big an impact in those women. So your risk, per se, is very much tied into your family, your genetics, and what your risk is for bone loss. So what do we do about that? Well, understanding what your bone mineral density is to start with is very important because obviously that gives us a window into what your genetics are and where you come from as an individual, where your family came from. So that's one important thing. Dr. Lane mentioned vitamin D. There's been a lot of interest in vitamin D, mainly because we found that women in a cohort study, so these are epidemiologic studies where they monitored women who'd had breast cancer and checked their vitamin D levels, and the women who had very low vitamin D levels appeared to have higher risks of recurrence or worse outcome. But that doesn't prove that actually taking vitamin D would prevent recurrence, or that women who take more vitamin D supplementation are at less risk for breast cancer. We really don't have any data to that regard. But I agree with Dr. Lane that it seems just common sense that taking a reasonable amount of vitamin D is a good idea now that we're trying to avoid sun and the risk of melanoma and skin aging. We really need to have that vitamin D in order to protect our bone health. We don't have any idea what that does in terms of our risk of developing breast cancer or our risks after we've had breast cancer diagnosed. But it goes along with our recommendations that you keep your weight under control, that you exercise, that you drink alcohol only in really significant moderation based on current data. So what do we do? Well, we check a bone mineral density with a DEXA scan in order to assess what your baseline is. We make sure that patients are taking an adequate amount of calcium and vitamin D. The Institute of Medicine recently declined to recommend, you know, significant supplementation, and again, it's because we don't have the outcome data yet. But I think it's reasonable to take 1,000 or 2,000 international units a day, and those pills are very small and easy to swallow, so that makes it easier too. And then we monitor bone mineral density over the course of time, and I think that we've migrated a bit. We used to say we're only going to treat women with bisphosphonates who have osteoporosis. Now what we do is we tend to treat women who have significant osteopenia, so some bone loss to start with, because we know those are the women who are at risk for developing osteoporosis during the course of treatment and for osteoporotic fractures in the long run. We know that women who take tamoxifen have relatively less bone loss, but if you're postmenopausal taking tamoxifen, it's still a risk that should be monitored. We now have a big array of different medications that we can take, including the oral bisphosphonates that have been the stalwart, you know, drugs like Fosamax, and those drugs can now be taken once a week or once a month with ibandronate, but Boniva. But I think that the main issue for most women is that they're a little less potent, and some women get GI or stomach upset with these medications, and you really have to pay attention to that symptom of reflux or gastritis-type symptoms. The other medications which are newer, we have Reclast, which is Zometa, the drug that we use in metastatic bone disease that you can get once a year. And then the newest drug is Prolia that Dr. Lane mentioned that you get twice a year as a subcutaneous injection. And both of those drugs are approved, but many insurers would like to see you take the oral medications first because they're significantly cheaper from an insurance standpoint. So we often will switch to those medications in women who still have continued bone loss despite the use of our standard medications. Now, what about the women who have bone metastases? What kinds of changes have we made in our understanding of the treatment of bone metastases? Well, we had been hoping that these drugs, the bisphosphonates in particular, would actually improve survival in women who have metastatic breast cancer, but it turns out what we're doing is improving quality of life and reducing the problems associated with bone metastases. It's too hard to assess the impact on survival because we have so many good medications now that help women to live longer, the actual hormone therapy and chemotherapy agents. But when patients have bone metastases, and in fact, you know, because the majority of breast cancer is hormone responsive, and hormone responsive breast cancers tend to, when they recur in bone, bone metastases are a big issue for women who have metastatic breast cancer. They can cause pain, fractures, disability, require continued medications with narcotics and things that really disrupt your quality of life. So our goal is to improve pain with the least amount of side effects, control pain, and then to prevent what we have defined, used a word called skeletal-related events, or SREs. What that means is pretty much anything that can happen to bone. So a fracture or just needing new treatment, having more pain, having a new bone metastasis or a new area of involvement, or needing radiation for an area. So we know that the use of bisphosphonates and now the use of this new drug, denosumab, referred to as Xgeva, which is a funny name, but you can easily remember it anyway, these drugs actually help to prevent progression of bone disease and help to control pain and delay the time to a new treatment for bone metastases. So they've made a really big impact on quality of life for patients. And the drugs that we use are either Zometa, Zoledronate, that's given intravenously once a month, although people are looking at less frequent dosing, and then this drug Xgeva, which is the same as Prolia, but it's given a different name and a different dose in the metastatic setting. It's a new drug. It works in a different mechanism of action than the bisphosphonates, and a randomized trial that was recently published studied these two drugs and found that Xgeva, or denosumab, controlled pain better, the effect lasted for longer. So it was a better drug than bisphosphonates in controlling bone metastases in this group of patients. However, both drugs are very useful. They each have their own individual side effect profiles. We'll talk a little bit about some of the issues in the mouth with Dr. Peterson in a few minutes. But they all have their own side effect profiles that we need to address with individual patients, and then there is a difference in cost. So I think the decisions about which agents to use need to be made with your oncologist, because the recent study showed that the XGEVA was superior to Zometa in these bone events, we've tended to start new patients on XGEVA, and when patients have progression on Zometa, switch over to XGEVA as a medication to control the pain and bone metastases. And then we know now that we have two agents, which is really very, very helpful. We have a lot of other treatment options, of course, the systemic therapy treatments that we talk about on other calls. And then there are some radiation medications that give sort of radiation to bone mets throughout the body. These drugs aren't used as much anymore. They caused a lot of problems with blood counts and other side effects and drugs like something called samarium. And we have enough alternatives that we just aren't using them as much. And then lastly, just to finish with the doctor-patient communication about quality of life concerns, both in the early stage and late stage setting, it's incredibly important to be able to communicate well with your healthcare team in terms of treating your cancer. And what I suggest to patients is they write down notes as they think about them in a notebook that you keep that has information about your breast cancer, your treatment, your laboratory studies, and your x-rays, and that you bring that notebook to each meeting. You keep on either computer or hand-done a series of events that have occurred during your treatment for breast cancer so that you know what treatments you've gotten. And when you see your doctor and you've forgotten everything that you just thought about, you have actually a written record to refer to. And then lastly, involving your friends, your family, in order to help record, to help you with questions, and then to record the conversation you have with your healthcare provider can really help with the communication overall.
Well, Dr. Rugo, that was really excellent and just outstanding, as always, presentation, and very compassionate also, just very warm and just lots of wonderful information. I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Julie Silver, and Dr. Silver is Assistant Professor, Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Silver is a doctor of rehabilitation medicine, and she's going to discuss the role of exercise and rehabilitation medicine in caring for your bones and controlling pain and discomfort. Dr. Silver?
Thanks, Carolyn. I want to talk first about the different types of exercise. And people obviously hear a lot about exercise, and they actually know a lot about exercise. So I want to present this the way that a rehab doctor would think about it. There's about five different types of exercise that we sort of categorize. Two of them I won't spend very much time on. One of them that I won't spend much time on are functional or balance exercises. And we use those a lot in people as they age or if they have chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy and they're having problems with falls and so on. That type of exercise would be appropriate. Another type that I'm not going to spend a lot of time on is sport-specific, and that would be if you're training, for example, in tennis or basketball and you're doing repetitive athletic activities. The three types I do want to talk about are the ones that most people focus on, and that's flexibility, strengthening, and cardiovascular training. The kind that's most important in bone health is strength training or resistance training. In fact, when you look at exercise in general, the least helpful is flexibility exercises, and that's often the type of exercise that people spend the most time on. So if you have, let's say, half an hour to exercise, you wouldn't want to spend 20 minutes stretching out because you really won't get maximal health benefits from that. The research really doesn't support a lot of health benefits from flexibility exercises, which doesn't mean that it's not important to stretch. It is fine to stretch, and it is good for you. But most of your time really should be spent on strength training and cardiovascular exercise. So that's what I want to talk about today. When it comes to bone health, both cardiovascular exercise and strength training can be helpful. Strength training is usually the most helpful. And when you're thinking about starting a strength training program, that usually is best done under some type of guidance. If you've always done some sort of resistance exercise and you're going back to your former routine, you certainly can do that gradually. But if you've never really done a strength training exercise program, then you'll want to do that with some guidance. There's a couple of ways to get help. First of all, you might want to consider getting a referral to a physical or occupational therapist to help you with that, to develop an individualized strength training program. Another way to get help is to go to an exercise physiologist or a certified cancer exercise trainer. These trainers are certified by the American College of Sports Medicine, and they specifically have information and knowledge about cancer survivors. So working with someone who is a professional can help you establish your program and then gradually advance your program. Cardiovascular exercise is also really important. Cardiovascular exercise are things like walking, swimming. Swimming tends to not be as helpful in bone health because there's not as much resistance, and walking tends to be a little bit better because you're bearing weight through your legs. But you don't want to forget about your core. And I know the doctors who spoke before me were talking a lot about spines and core strength. The middle of your body is a really important part of your body to strengthen. So walking alone will not get you core strength. You want to combine the cardiovascular and the strength training together in a program. And how do you do that when you're so exhausted and you can't even really think about starting a new program? Well, I'm actually a breast cancer survivor, and I'll tell you how I did it, and this is what I recommend to my patients. The very first thing that I did was just to go on the telephone. Every time the phone rang, I would get on my treadmill or I'd get on my elliptical machine, or I would just walk and pace. And I started counting how many steps I would take, and I used a pedometer. And I knew that 10,000 steps a day was what was recommended for active, healthy adults. But I wasn't even close to 10,000 steps a day. When I wasn't talking on the phone, I would get so bored and tired, and all I could think about was how tired I was that I wanted to stop. But when I was talking on the phone, believe it or not, even though I was using air and talking and so on, I actually could go much longer because I wasn't thinking about it. So I would really build up my steps and my stamina by just getting on my treadmill or getting on my elliptical machine or just walking around my house every single time the phone rang and every time I had to take a phone call. Then I started doing a resistance program, and I had done lifted weights before and so on, but I decided that I actually needed to make an appointment and go somewhere. You can do that. You can take a class. You can go to a personal trainer. You can meet a friend at the gym. There's a lot of ways to do that. I decided to go to a personal trainer because I wanted to make an appointment and actually have someone that I was responsible to. I knew what to do, but I wanted some encouragement. A lot of exercise is really about motivation. It's similar to eating well. It's really about how do you stay motivated, because it's not really a lot of fun, especially when you're not feeling very good. So I would make an appointment, and I would go see my trainer, and every time the phone rang, I would walk and walk. Well, a lot of times people are derailed because they have pain. Maybe they have shortness of breath. There's all kinds of other things going on in their lives. If you have symptoms when you're exercising, you definitely want to talk to your doctor. If you haven't exercised before and you're not going back to your regular program, talk to your doctor. It's really a great idea to talk to your doctor no matter what, but I will tell you one very safe thing to do is get a pedometer and put it on and just see how many steps a day you're taking, because that's not even exercise to start with. All you're doing right now is counting how many steps you're already taking. So you really don't need your doctor's permission to count how many steps you're already taking. And then as you decide to gradually go up on your steps, it's usually safe to increase by, say, 10% to 20% per week. So let's say that you were taking 5,000 steps a day and the goal is 10,000 steps today. You could go up by about 500 steps per day every week. So maybe in 1 to 2 months, you'd be up to the 10,000 range. That's usually safe for most people to do. Again, I always recommend if you have any questions, you're worried about anything, talk to your doctor, and your doctor can help you. And strength training is a little different, and you really should get some advice, especially if you've never done any strength training. Here's a few tips about controlling pain and so on. Consider taking your medications before you work out so that you don't have a lot of aching and you can get through your workout comfortably. You may also need to take them after you exercise as well, whether they're anti-inflammatory medications or opiate medications or whatever you're taking. Definitely warm up and cool down. If you do wear a lymphedema garment, a pressure stocking, you need to wear that when you work out, especially if you're doing weight training. Keep in mind that in order to build strength, it goes by what we call the overload principle of strength training, which means you have to overload the muscle to actually build strength. That means a high load, low repetition activity. If you're doing strength training by doing lots and lots and lots of repetitions really fast and going really fast, that's actually more like a cardiovascular exercise than a strength training. It's not as good for your bones. It won't build strength as much. And you probably don't have to work so hard. It would be better to do a little bit more weight and then do it gently in a few reps. Keep in mind, I know a lot of people are worried about having lymphedema, worsening lymphedema, and so on. In general, the studies show that it will not make lymphedema worse, or you will not get lymphedema because you do strength training, as long as you do it in a guided exercise program and you don't overdo it. And finally, here's a couple of tips on how to stay motivated. When your friends stop bringing meals or they ask you, how can I help, tell them one way you can help is to just go out and take a walk with me or meet me somewhere to get coffee and walk there or bike there or have them go swimming with you or whatever it takes. But ask them to help you with your exercise program and have that be your motivation to get out and do what you need to do.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Silver. Excellent presentation, very informative, and really giving people all sorts of tips of exercises and things that people can do and try and consulting with their healthcare team. So I know there'll be questions for you as well during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Douglas Peterson. Dr. Peterson is a dentist. He's professor of oral medicine, chair, program, and head and neck cancer and oral oncology, NAE Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Connecticut Health Center. And Dr. Peterson is really going to talk about caring for your teeth and gums before, during, and after breast cancer treatments. Dr. Peterson?
Thank you very much, Carolyn. My colleagues on the call have really provided an excellent foundation for my next few minutes sharing with you some guidelines and insights relative to caring for teeth and gums in relation to breast cancer treatments. As we've already talked about, it becomes very, very important from very early on in the breast cancer diagnosis that there be an ongoing communication among the patient, the family, the cancer team. And this is particularly true as well when it comes to the mouth before, during, and after the breast cancer treatment. And I say this because not all breast cancer treatments cause mouth problems, either during or in the years following the cancer treatment. However, given the complexity of some of the mouth complications that can occur in some patients, it is important to have a comprehensive management by the healthcare team, including prevention of mouth problems where possible. And this is really where dental checkups before the breast cancer treatment begins can definitely help set the stage for a very, very successful treatment. And so some tips that I would ask you to consider before the cancer treatment starts: ask your oncology team if there are any short-term or long-term effects from the best breast cancer treatment that might occur in the mouth, including the teeth and gums. And then also, are there any problems in my mouth that may complicate my breast cancer treatment? And based on these answers, your dentist and hygienist can work with the rest of the cancer team to examine your mouth and prioritize any dental treatment that may be needed before and after your breast cancer treatment. And this collaboration, beginning very early on, can definitely lead to important and very positive outcomes of your treatment. And I'd also say there are excellent resources that are available to patients and the families and the cancer teams to help guide this decision-making and its treatments. Cancer Care is one example of these resources, and they in turn can refer you to other sources. And so achieving excellent health of your teeth and gums and the lining tissues of your mouth is always an important goal in any patient. And as dental providers, we work very hard with our patients to achieve that. However, when it comes to breast cancer treatment, it's important to recognize that not all mouth disease, not all tooth and gum disease, for example, that we may find in a patient needs to be treated before the breast cancer treatment begins. For example, a very minor dental cavity or a cosmetic procedure can typically easily wait until well after the cancer treatment ends. However, there are certain types of dental and gum problems, such as deep dental cavities or severe gum disease that involves the jawbone, that may well require treatment before the breast cancer treatment begins. And again, these issues can be discussed with your cancer team, and including the dental team. I'd like to take just another couple minutes and talk briefly about a condition we've already begun to hear about today with our other speakers, and that's called osteonecrosis of the jaw, or ONJ. And basically, ONJ is a condition of the jawbones, the upper and lower jawbones, that occurs in relation to use of some bisphosphonates and some of the newer drugs that Drs. Lane and Dr. Rugo have mentioned. ONJ is often but not always related to tooth and gum problems that are existing before the bone protective treatment begins. So having these tooth and gum problems taken care of, treated before beginning the bisphosphonates or some of the newer drugs, can go a long way to minimizing any risks of developing ONJ. And I'd like to emphasize two very important points, because you might have heard about osteonecrosis of the jaw in relation to these bone protective agents. First of all, the condition, ONJ, does not occur in most patients receiving these bone protective drugs, a relatively small percent. And secondly, as we've already heard from Drs. Lane and Rugo, there are really tremendous benefits of these bone protective agents, including cancer treatment and maintaining the skeleton. And so trying to minimize the risk of ONJ by stopping these bone protective agents is often counterproductive. In virtually all cases, it's best to continue these drugs that protect the bone and may be very effective in fighting the cancer too. In addition to the tooth and gum diseases that may represent a risk for development of ONJ in a small percentage of patients, there are a few other risk factors, including certain types of bisphosphonates. We heard about zoledronate and pimidronate and ibandronate. These are some of the drugs that are associated with ONJ. However, ONJ has been associated with many different types of bisphosphonates and some of the newer drugs that are coming into clinical practice as well. Older age, including bone loss associated with aging in women, long-term use of steroids, diabetes, and even smoking has been associated with increased risk of ONJ, but more research is needed along many of these lines. But again, I'd like to really emphasize that the benefits of starting and staying on bone protective agents under the medical supervision by your physician team far outweigh the risks of ONJ development. So in summary, I'd like to highlight that not all breast cancer patients develop mouth problems during and in the years following the cancer treatment. Not all dental disease needs to be treated before the breast cancer treatment begins. There are many important benefits of the bone protective agents, the bisphosphonates and some of the newer drugs, that typically far outweigh the small risk of developing ONJ. Again, this is an important discussion with your cancer team. And these kinds of discussions with your cancer team before the breast cancer treatment begins can be very, very beneficial for not only the whole body, but also the teeth and the gums and the other structures in the mouth during and after the cancer treatment ends. This partnership between the cancer team and the patient and the family can lead to excellent outcomes for years to come. Carolyn, I'll stop there and turn this back to you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peterson, really just for giving such a wonderful perspective on care of mouth and gums and teeth, and also the whole issue of the multidisciplinary team in action. I think everyone is having a chance to see all the different specialty physicians here who are available to help you as you try to determine your best course of treatment. So thank you very much. Our next speaker is Pat Spicer. Pat is an oncology social worker, and she is our breast cancer program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Pat's going to go over with you the free services that you can access from Cancer Care. Pat?
Thank you, Carolyn. I'd also like to comment on how wonderful this presentation was, because for women dealing with breast cancer or dealing with survivorship after breast cancer treatment, one of the things that always comes up in groups or in conversations with these patients is, what can I do to help myself? And today, certainly, everyone was offered good, solid, practical advice, things that they can do easily no matter what the stage of their disease or their recovery period. So I think this was especially important for women who are trying to deal with not only their treatment, but the aftermath of treatment. It was an especially good program. At Cancer Care, we want to be part of that support team. And to contact us, you can call us directly at 1-800-813-4673, or you can reach us online at www.cancercare.org. We offer face-to-face counseling, telephone and online support groups, and wonderful programs such as the ones you've heard today. We can also be of assistance in many cases with financial help. Carolyn, I'll turn it back to you because I know there are lots of questions.
Well, thank you very much, Pat, very eloquently describing the services we have. And we do have time for questions and lots of time for questions. If we don't get to your question, just please call Cancer Care at the end of the call, and we will address your questions at that point. Mary, would you bring all of our speakers on board, and would you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions, and we will take the questions as quickly as we can.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Sharon G.
Hello. I've been diagnosed with O&J for about a year now, and I was wondering, my doctor wants to put me back on Zometa. And I know that you said it was better to be on it than off of it, but since I do have O&J, I'm wondering what I'm really supposed to be doing.
Okay. Sharon, thanks for an excellent question. I'm going to ask two of our speakers to address your question in a general way, and then we're going to ask you to go back to your treating healthcare team with their recommendations. Dr. Peterson, can you just describe a little bit about the care of O&J, and then Dr. Rugo, if you could just discuss the general concept of treatment with O&J. Dr. Peterson?
Yes, thank you for the very important question, Sharon. You raise a very important issue, and that is, what do we know about discontinuing or starting patients on a bisphosphonate when they have active O&J? And I will say that the research is only beginning to emerge on the best way to manage this. But the principles that we use in management of O&J of the upper and lower jaw include very conservative treatment, typically antibiotics as needed, and very, very good local wound care. There is some recent early evidence that not having Zometa on board may help in healing the O&J, but I do want to be very careful here, and then I'll turn it over to Dr. Rugo. The benefits of the Zometa decision for your whole body may far outweigh the potential risk that the healing of O&J may be slowed if you go back on Zometa. So the bottom line is, I'd reinforce what Carolyn Messner has said, and it's a discussion with your healthcare team. Perhaps, Dr. Rugo, you could expand upon this?
Dr. Rugo?
Yes, I think understanding exactly what your individual situation is always critical to deciding what to do with the bisphosphonate. And so you've been taking, how long were you on the bisphosphonate? Do we know that, Carolyn?
We don't, but if you could answer in a general way in terms of.
I will. So I think that, you know, so if you could think of a few different situations, mostly, you know, we're thinking about maintaining bone health and preventing, you know, some helping pain control and preventing fractures. And so if you've been on the bisphosphonate for a long time and you develop osteonecrosis, stopping it until you've healed, from the medical oncology standpoint, is not a big risk to you in terms of your disease, because you store the bisphosphonate for a long time in bone. We want to make sure, obviously, that you have adequate calcium and vitamin D, that your pain is well controlled, the radiation is used as necessary. But the bisphosphonate per se is not the most critical part of your health care. And, you know, it would have been nice if we could have switched to this new drug, Xgeva, but since it also causes osteonecrosis at about the same rate, it's really not a viable option. So what we've done is treat the osteonecrosis. Many times antibiotics are used in local care. You heard about this before, you know, we don't want to do anything else too aggressive, but we do hold the bisphosphonate. I mean, it's sitting in the bone, but I found that not having the higher levels systemically at least makes us feel like we're making some positive intervention towards healing of the osteonecrosis. So I wouldn't feel anxious about taking away a medication that's making a big difference after you've already been on it for a while. I would feel comfortable with holding it.
Can I ask one question, Dr. Peterson? There's a recent article that suggested that PTH 1 to 34 could heal osteonecrosis of the jaw. Is there any information about using an anabolic agent for a short period of time to speed through the healing?
And Dr. Peterson, could you just explain to the audience what those terms mean?
Well, just basically to help the bone recover faster, I guess is the simplest way to put it. And I'm aware of the general line of research, but I would consider it still very early in the evolution. And just as the understanding of how best to manage ONJ in these patients is still evolving. I mean, we've learned a tremendous amount over the past few years. I'd really like to reinforce the theme, though, that this is an individually based discussion depending on a number of considerations with your cancer team.
Excellent. And it does raise the issue, Dr. Peterson, if you could comment just on the concept of participation in clinical trials. If the research is beginning, that there probably are trials where there's interest in people learning more about this, and of course that always takes many people to participate in those research trials. Do you want to comment on that? Or?
Yes, another very important point. Thank you. The idea of participating in clinical trials, and in this case in breast cancer clinical trials, or agents that we use to help control some of the side effects from the breast cancer treatments, other clinical trials. This is something that might be offered to you. I'd ask you to consider it carefully. There is absolutely no requirement for one, for a patient to participate in these trials. We work very hard to address any questions or concerns. If at any point one decides to participate in a clinical trial and then wishes to stop participating in the trial, there are no influences on the patient's clinical management. The benefit of this kind of gift that patients give us by participating in clinical trials can lead to years of new, very positive treatments in the future for new patients who may develop problems. And just as we're beneficiaries of those who've gifted us through clinical trial participation in years past, in turn, we like to try and advance the science and really ask that patients consider these opportunities very, very carefully for the future.
And Carolyn, if your doctor has not spoken to you about clinical trial, you might want to ask them if there is anything that might be relevant to your situation. Discuss with your doctor whether you would be suitable to be enrolled in a clinical trial.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good idea. This is Hope Rugo, but I will say that this is an exciting new approach, but there aren't a whole lot of trials available right now, and so that if there isn't one in your area, it would not be an unreasonable thing because they're just so new and few and far between. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll see a real growth of this.
Well, a real good site, if you're interested or your physician is interested in referring you, is the National Cancer Institute's website, and they provide a complete listing of the clinical trials, and also Emerging Med will run a study for you and find any clinical trials that may be applicable to your situation. But again, discussing them with your physician, asking your doctor if there is anything that you could be part of, is a wonderful gift that you give to yourself and to everybody else.
And I would say that the information about the National Cancer Institute trials, that information is in the materials you receive from us, and it's you can call their 800 number or you can visit their website, cancer.gov. It's a wonderful informational source. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Polly P.
Yes, hello. I didn't realize the other woman was going to ask her question, and mine is very much related. I also have ONJ to two teeth where there is significant bone loss, and one tooth is loose. I assume you would suggest that I would not be staying on Zomata, which I was on for 7 years. Is that correct?
Okay, thank you for that question, Polly. Dr. Brugo and Dr. Peterson, do you want to address this?
If you have, you know, these problems, we would not continue on a bisphosphonate. That's correct. Nor would we start you on a different medication for bone. And I think that it's just really important to realize that that doesn't put you at some horrible risk. You know, you have got a lot of exposure to bisphosphonate. And so you obviously want to, you know, make sure your bones are as healthy as possible by the means we talked about earlier, but you definitely want to allow healing, and the current idea is to really not use the bisphosphonate.
And I would just add that the healing of the ONJ, because we do really work to conservatively manage it rather than extensive extractions and extensive surgeries of the bone and so forth, we try and, as Dr. Lane mentioned, we try and manage this very conservatively as well, and Dr. Rugo as well. So the wound care topically, the antibiotics, and some of the other non-surgical approaches can be very, very important. It may take quite some time. It may take several months, sometimes longer, for the ONJ to actually resolve in this setting. So don't be discouraged. Continue to comply with all of the recommendations from your healthcare team. And over time, that ONJ will hopefully heal quite nicely.
And Dr. Peterson, I think this question often comes up on this call and on other calls as well. Are there specialties within in terms of dentists that people should consider seeing, or people at academic centers or comprehensive centers, in terms of the treatment of their, you know, just getting, we always, you know, getting a second opinion, or in terms of giving the very best care for the ONJ problem?
Yeah, I think certainly dentists in an academic setting, such as myself, who follow this kind of work, can be a resource for the team. Also, because we're talking principally about a jawbone problem, the dental specialties that deal principally with the jawbone problems include oral and maxillofacial surgeons and periodontists. Those are two. But again, I think it depends on each patient's circumstance and access to dental care, and going to the family dentist, who in turn can bring in some of this other expertise as needed, can be a very, very productive approach.
Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Adeline Jean B.
Hi. How many steps is good or a good goal for cardiovascular exercise? And also, thank you for this wonderful panel.
Oh, thank you, Adeline. And I'm going to ask Dr. Silva to address that about the steps.
Sure. The goal is 10,000 steps a day for active, healthy people. Obviously, if you've been through cancer treatment, you may not fit that category right now. And so that's why I suggest starting with just wearing a pedometer and seeing where you're at. So maybe you're taking 2,000 steps a day. And maybe the next goal would be to get up to 2,500 or 2,300 steps a day. Just increase gradually. And definitely, if you do have cardiovascular disease, you want to check in with your doctor and just make sure that it's safe for you to increase your walking. You can ask about not only increasing your walking distance, but also the pace, the speed, and how much your heart rate goes up. And your doctor can give you different parameters. Maybe your doctor will have you check your heart rate and not go over a certain number or something like that. But the first thing you can do is just get a pedometer. You can get one online at many stores, at sporting goods stores. Lots of places have them. They're very inexpensive usually. Don't pay more than between $10 and $20. Don't pay more than that for a pedometer. You can even get them for less than that. But just get an inexpensive one and try it out and just see how many steps you're taking now.
Excellent. Well, actually, I want to thank our speakers. You've just been an extraordinary group, a multidisciplinary panel, just really presenting on this topic with such expertise and compassion. And I want to also thank all of those who've been on the call and asked such great questions, that really, really extraordinary questions. This has in general been an extraordinary call. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening as well. I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour program. However, although the program will end soon in terms of this workshop over the telephone, there are many services that you can access from Cancer Care. So although the workshop itself will be ending soon, your connection to help and to hope from Cancer Care, that continues endlessly. And I do want to remind you that we have a staff of 60 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we are here to provide a host of services to you at no cost. And we offer practical and financial assistance. We offer counseling, a chance to talk to one of our social workers here, a chance to participate in a telephone or online support group. We have many of these type of programs. You have materials about all the upcoming programs that we're offering. We have quite a few, and with your recommendations, telling us other topics you'd like us to do, we'll try to incorporate those as well. And we also have many publications and fact sheets. So most importantly, as we conclude, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone. I want you to feel that you're part of a community of support and of hope, and that we are here to help you. And we are simply a phone call away or a mouse click away. So you can either call us at 1-800-813-HOPE or www.cancercare.org. I want to thank you all for participating today, and remember that you're now part of this community of support, and you simply have to call us when you feel that you need some support or help. Thank you all, and have a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.